Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been, and it always will be.
Welcome to White Line Fever, episode 82. I've got a broken computer. I started editing the podcast in an internet cafe here in Manchester, and I realised that there was no first segment. There was no introduction. So here we are. We're at Hotel Sport, right next to Old Trafford, and we're just about to launch the England-New Zealand Test Series, and I'm here with the great Stuart Pike from the BBC and any number of other outlets. How are you, Stuart?
Good. Good to see you. I can't believe that you've turned up here. But look, I don't know if you ever had the programme down under. It's an antiques programme called Lovejoy, featuring Ian McShane, and it was legendary over here. And he had a beard and long black hair, and he wore a black leather jacket. And he was a bit of a chaser, you know. He was a bit of a con artist. So if the book fits.
I am a victim of con artists, but the reason I'm wearing the leather jacket is because I've got two jackets with me. One's a nice big overcoat, and one's a leather jacket, which I bought here about 10 years ago, and I had to choose which one would I rather lose, so I carry the one that I would rather lose. That's the only reason I'm wearing it. But most of the listeners will be hearing this after this weekend's game, so we're not going to focus on that, but I believe you are calling a very 11th hour deal, or was it, for Premier Sports to broadcast Leeds and New Zealand.
Very much an 11th hour deal. Got a call 48 hours before the game. I think it's sort of Leeds have been very much involved with it, and also the Kiwis, because they wanted it broadcast on Sky Sport back in New Zealand. So, yep, Leeds against New Zealand. Yestin Harris, former dual code international, former Wales coach, former Salford coach, former this, that and the other, ex this, that and the other. He's joining me in commentary. So, all good. The more league on telly, the better, of course.
Exactly. Let's talk about the Test Series. Does English Rugby League have a lot to gain from winning this series, and not much to lose, really? Because I guess if they don't go well, it won't capture the imagination of the mainstream. But if they do well, suddenly with the rugby union team having gone poorly, could really be a boom for the game.
Not too much milk was spilt when England Rugby Union lost, I can tell you. But I think it's an important series. I mean, it's important for New Zealand as well. And don't forget, I mean, New Zealand, number one in the world, but they've come out here without so many big stars. I was reading that there's only a quarter of the team that won the Anzac Test against Australia and Brisbane who are out here on this tour, but it still looks really, really strong. I think we're all hoping, I mean, from the BBC's point of view, the final Test match is on National Radio 5, so we're all hoping that it's 1-1 going to Wigan in a couple of weeks. But I think for England, huge. For Steve McNamara, huge. I mean, he held on to his job probably by his fingernails after losing the World Cup and then the Four Nations disappointment. So it's a huge series for McNamara if he wants to stay coach of England. I'm absolutely certain.
What's your involvement going to be? What are you calling all three games?
No, I'm only doing the last one. I'm trying to juggle. You know, just like you, I'm a media whore, Steve. So the first two Test matches, I'm actually doing darts commentary in Belgium. For the European Championship for ITV, and then the following weekend when the Test match is in London, I'm doing darts for Sky in the Midlands. But I asked them if I could have a day off to do the final Test match for the BBC.
And you get regular trips to Oz with the darts, don't you?
Well, back there next August, the World Series of Darts, absolutely huge. Last year in Perth, Sydney and then Auckland, sold out every night. Nine nights of dart, absolutely sold out. They're mad for it. We're looking for a new venue in Sydney, because the Qantas Arena is coming down, of course. But
Cole Chisel are closing it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, I thought Elton John...
Did you see them at the Grand Final? Oh, you're right.
I thought Elton John was closing it, yeah. But I think the darts probably closed it after we had, you know, 20 pints each on the night. But yeah, absolutely huge. Absolutely huge, the darts. So it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. In Auckland, they sold out three nights, 5,000 people a night inside a day, so... Mm.
Before we go, what can you tell us about this place? It's owned by a couple of Man U's finest, isn't it? This hotel.
Hotel Football, right in the shadow of Old Trafford, where, of course, a couple of weeks ago we saw one of the best grand finals. It couldn't match the drama in Sydney with North Queensland beating Brisbane, but ours was pretty good. Yeah, Hotel Football, owned by Gary Neville and Ryan Giggs. They're also opening a boutique hotel in the centre of Manchester, and they also, along with Nicky Butt and Paul Scholes, the class of 92, it's called, the Man United Stars of the past, they own Salford City Football Club, which is slowly but surely going through the ranks of English football. I think they're about seven divisions off the Premier League, but they've poured a load of money into a local football team to try and get that going. So they've got their fingers in lots of pies, but hotel football is, well, it's perfectly placed. It's a guaranteed sellout every 2 weeks, isn't it? It's 50 yards from Old Trafford, but yeah, true businessmen as well as good football players.
Yeah, that would be great if they could get involved in helping out rugby league. Thanks for joining us, Pike. We'll see you during the series. As most of the listeners would be aware, I go to a few gigs while I'm here as well. And the first one I saw when I landed was Michael Monroe. Here's a new song from him. Thank you. I like it.
Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. You get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever, rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.
Welcome back to the program. And our very, very special guest is Keith Nelson from Buckcherry. How are you, Keith?
I'm good, man. What's going on down there?
Yeah, we're just trying to stay warm. Actually, we do have winter here. People don't think we do, but it does get cold occasionally. I am really, for me, it's like your new album's called Rock and Roll, but for me, it's good that you put out an album, because I thought after you did that EP, you might be doing that from now on. You know, you might be just putting out a song at a time or an EP at a time. So that was never the plan, though, I guess.
No, I mean, the EP was really just done for fun. And, we're talking about doing a few more here and there, but we still believe in the full-length record.
Right.
Don't you worry about that.
And that actually ties into the whole rock and roll is dead thing, isn't it? Because I wonder, when Gene Simmons says rock and roll is dead, does he mean as an art form, or does he just mean commercially, as a business?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the biggest selling music right now in the United States is not rock and roll, so it's easy to jump on the bandwagon and say it's over. But, I mean, we go out and we play every night to hundreds, if not thousands, of people who firmly believe that rock and roll is alive and well.
Yeah.
And so I don't care what anyone has to say about it.
So the title of the album's a bit of a mission statement, is it?
I think so. You know, we didn't come up with the title until the record was done. And it was people such as the gentleman you mentioned before saying that rock is dead, and that kind of prevailing thought in the, you know, which is totally contrary to what we're actually living, that made us go, yeah, let's fucking call the record rock and roll. No one else will.
Yeah, that, and it's such a change of pace from Confessions, isn't it? Because it's more fun, I guess. Confessions is quite a serious record.
Yeah, Confessions was really serious, and we kind of, you know, looking back, maybe we reacted to it a little bit by doing the fuck record, very irreverent, and just like, let's do whatever the fuck we want to do. And this is more like, let's write the best song. They don't have to be about any kind of common theme. Let's just do what we do. Let's write songs. Let's play them. Let's have some fun and see what happens.
Right. Maybe
that's how we ended up with Rock and Roll.
Okay. And what are your touring plans, Keith? Obviously, although I'm hoping people are listening to us everywhere, I'm in Australia, so I'm keen to know if you're coming here.
We are definitely going to be pounding the United States and Europe and Canada from now to the end of the year. And hopefully, fingers crossed, getting back down under to Australia in 2016.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I did warn you that we're going to play a song every now and then. So do you have one for us, Keith, the first song of the interview?
Why don't you play The Madness off of the new record?
Can you tell us a bit about the inspiration behind it? I've only had time to have one listen to the whole album, so.
Yeah, well, musically, it was just, I wanted to have a song that was like three different personalities in one song, you know, like a punk part, more of a wide open chorus kind of thing, and you know, the heavy part, which is what the verses would be in the intro. And I came up with that music, and I sent it over to Josh, and he came up with those lyrics, which I do believe, I can't speak for the man, but I do believe it's about that internal wrestling match that we all have, you know, the good versus the evil, all inside your head. And there you go, The Madness.
Don't be scared by what you find, it's you.
What's up? This is Keith from Brock Cherry, and you're listening to White Line Fever. Turn that shit up.
Okay, welcome back to the program. It's been a few weeks since I did the last one. I want to apologize for that. It's just been pretty busy. Before I introduce our guest, I've got to plug a couple of things. We're on Twitter, WLF Podcast. We're on Facebook. It's just White Line Fever. And also the site for the website is whitelinefever.ning.com. Please go to iTunes and make a comment, make a request, give us a rating. Helps get us noticed a little bit. So, well, we are in the back of a car. We are heading towards London, and we've been to a European Championship game between Wales and Scotland. And I'm with the, is it managing director? Is it?
No.
What is it?
It's the RLEF, the Rugby League European Federation General Manager.
General Manager, Danny Kazanjian. How are you, Danny?
I'm very good, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Did you enjoy the game tonight?
I did. It was a really close fought game. I think the recent history of the European Championship always conjures up, throws up some very closely fought contests. This was no exception. Congratulations to Wales, first win in several years. And I think everyone who was at the game really enjoyed it.
Is it tough with the European Championship? Sort of, you're competing with so many other things at this time of year. In rugby league, you've got the Kiwi Tour, and then you've got the Rugby Union World Cup. So many other things going on. Is it hard to sort of get some traction?
No, I think on the contrary, I think the European Championship is a huge brand. I think it's a brand that the game really needs to celebrate and really needs to nurture. I think it can become a commercial success for us. The very fact that this is our 80th edition of the European Championship tells us that there's a legacy and great heritage attached to the competition. And now the European Federation's really focused on making sure that the competition gets increased visibility through broadcast arrangements, and that we have a regular place for it in the calendar.
Okay, a lot of listeners would have read your name and they wouldn't know much about you. So why don't we get a little bit of background? And your dad and your brother are in the front of the car here, and if you tell any lies, they're going to cough loudly. So how did you come to have this position in the game?
I was born in a village in Halifax, and I think it was Todd Mawson, very famous for alien abductions. Well, other than that story, there's another one. I'm from North London, from Barnet, born and raised in Barnet. Just got into rugby league really through watching State of Origin. Was waiting with a friend of mine who was Welsh to watch a football game, a World Cup qualifier, and Sky bumped it and put State of Origin on. This was the year when Paul Hough was fullback for Queensland, I believe 90 or 91. The one series he played, I think, for Queensland. And our jaws really hit the floor when we saw Origin. That's what rugby should have been like to us. We played rugby union in school and for the county, and really just got into it and wanted to play it and learn a bit more about it. Went to my school rugby practice where my rugby coach was a northerner, and asked him why we can't play rugby league because it's clearly a much better sport. And he said, well, don't talk to me about that rubbish, which piqued my interest even more. Why would he say that about just another sport that was clearly fun to play, clearly athletic? So I got reading a little bit about it, and as a natural historian myself, someone drawn to the past, it intrigued me. And I became more and more interested in the sport and more passionate about it. And I guess there's that common phrase about converts becoming uber passionate about their newfound faith. And I guess that really characterises my attachment with the sport. And it's been a singular passion of mine ever since.
And you helped start, or did, maybe are responsible for starting rugby league in Lebanon. What was the connection to Lebanon? Because we haven't touched on that yet.
My father's Armenian, but he was born and raised in Lebanon, in Beirut. So I was working in the rugby league media. I was a producer of a website just before the 2000 World Cup. So when we knew that the Lebanese team were qualified, we wanted to do something for them. So we met them at the airport with some other Lebanese people and had a bit of a song and dance for them. And incidentally, they were on the same flight as the New Zealand team, and some American tourists were waiting in the foyer with us, and they could only think how great the Lebanese team must have been, because the New Zealand team traipsed past without any fanfare and in great silence, and there was a lot of celebration for the Lebanese team. So I think the Lebanese guys were pretty surprised about that and thankful for it. And my association with the idea of Lebanese rugby league, which certainly was not my idea, it was, I guess that credit goes to Johnny Elias and his brother George Elias,
and Anthony.
Bluey, talk about Bluey.
Yeah.
Well, he's not a relative, but his part in the nucleus, the kernel of the idea of Lebanese rugby league, I can't comment on. So I got in touch with them, stayed in touch with them, and really wanted to get involved in the game. And I really had the idea, one epiphany, really, because I was writing about football. I was a freelance football writer, so I could have done that anywhere. So I had an idea, let's go and start rugby league in Lebanon, and went out there on a fact-finding trip in 2001, met some university heads, got speaking to them, and said, right, I'm going to come back, and that's what I did.
And then how did you end up with this job at the RLEF?
I started in Lebanon in March 2002, and started with the RLEF several years after that in a position that was named the Euro Med Development Director, so looking after nucleus, the very nascent Middle East countries. Really, at that stage, there was only Lebanon, some flirtations with other Middle Eastern countries without really taking root, and of course there was the Mediterranean countries that were also fairly new. In 2010 I moved back to London and took over as general manager.
And what is it like, what does the job sort of involve, like what's your average day? You're based in Fitzrovia?
Yeah, we have a new office in Fitzrovia that we share with three other organisations: the Rugby League International Federation, the London Rugby League Foundation, and the RFL. So since I've been back in London working for the RLEF, we've had several offices, a fairly nomadic existence, but we're in a great part of London now. It's a really exceptional headquarters for us. We've changed the official headquarters of the RLEF from Red Hall to 20 Fitzroy Square at Company's House, so that is our statutory address now. As for my day-to-day role, I don't really think you can say there's anything like an average day. I'm totally privileged and honoured to do what I do. It's just a fantastic journey being able to work and interact on a daily basis with so many other people from so many different cultures all around the world. I think most listeners will realise that the RLEF is a misnomer, that it's certainly more than a European federation. It's effectively a Northern Hemisphere federation. Our focus has really been on building participation, working ever so hard on governance, which is something that hasn't really been a focus of the game in the new countries in European Rugby League before 2010, 2011. I think we all understand it's absolutely critical to get the governance right if those individual nations, the associations and federations that run them, and by association the sport is really going to grow. So I could speak for more time than your podcast allows about what my job entails, but really interacting with the federations. I see myself and the European Federation here to serve our members' interests wherever we can. Competition, running competitions, oversight on governance, a lot of paperwork, interacting with the European Union a lot, Yeah, and just trying to assist the membership wherever we can.
Okay, let's talk about a couple of things that have been in the news recently. The coach of Serbia running onto the field and punching an Irish player, leading to the abandonment of that game. Is that matter now settled? Have the disciplinary procedures taken place? What's happened?
Yeah, well, first of all, just to be absolutely factual, he was not found guilty of punching. Okay. That could not be proven. It has been concluded. It's a very difficult time for Marko Jankovic, the Serbian coach. It's a very difficult time for the Serbian Rugby League Federation. The RLEF Disciplinary Committee dealt with it with the Serbian Federation officials that were on duty that day. Unfortunately, Marko got a signed eye penalty with no chance of appeal before 3 years. I think the positive aspect of the whole incident was the way in which the Serbian Rugby League Federation, which is one of our most proactive, most effective and most respectable organisations, dealt with the issue. Certainly not an issue that they had to deal with in the past, and one that really put them under the spotlight. They had to manage all of their many stakeholder relationships with sponsors, with donors such as the Australian Embassy, and I think the ambassador was present at the game and witnessed it, and left due to her disappointment with what had happened. And last but not least, the Serbian Sports Ministry themselves, as the Serbian Federation is a member of the Serbian Sports Ministry. So, as Serbia has made such progress over the last few years, this year has been, in my opinion, really a clear year to show the Serbian Federation that they're going on to this next level and that they're being heavily scrutinised and that they need to make sure that every single part of their organisation, not just their club development and their competition development, but their governance, their match official education, their disciplinary proceedings, and the way that their board deals with the most unsavoury of subjects is up to scratch. And I think what's really promising is that all of the leadership realise that and have embraced it, and the Serbian Federation is going to be a better organisation because of it.
So Marko Jankovic is it a life ban with no chance of appeal inside 3 years, or is it a 3-year ban?
I'm not a Latin native speaker, but I think sine die means without end. So the judgment was without end, but with no chance of appeal before 3 years. So
okay.
Marko will have the opportunity to make a submission to the European Federation, and I would suspect that the first port of call for him would be the Serbian Federation, to suggest that he's a reformed character and that he's served his penalty and that he deserves a second chance.
Okay. Now, more recently, we had Greece forfeiting a World Cup qualifier. That's got to be hugely disappointing.
Yeah, it was really disappointing. The European Federation funds these competitions. We understand that the grant that we give does not cover every penny of expenses associated with running a team in this competition. We do know that Greece has been hit harder than most or all European countries with the economic, the well-documented economic distresses that it's suffering from, and that clearly played a huge part in this. If you ask the Greek Federation if they would have liked to have handled this differently, if they would have liked to have informed us perhaps a little bit earlier, and certainly the Maltese perhaps a little bit earlier, I'm sure they would say yes, but I think in their defence, they were doing everything they could to get the match on. They were seeking sponsors. I don't think they wanted to let anybody down at all. But at the end of the day, a match, as you rightly say, that has a close a link with the World Cup qualifiers hasn't taken place, and that is hugely disappointing.
So is that matter is not settled yet as far as what the result, you know, what the ramifications of that's undetermined at this point?
Well, the result itself has been determined by the European Federation Board. They met immediately after Greece pulled out, and the board decided that, having considered the evidence they had at the time, it would be appropriate to award the match 30-0 to Malta. However, we are still in the midst of an internal inquiry which we're dealing with the Hellenic Federation on, and if there are any other elements of that report that require the European Federation Board to make further sanctions or rulings, then it will do. But that inquiry is still ongoing.
Right. I mean, have you, just generally speaking, I mean, I think rugby league fans sort of seem, on international football, seem to fall into two groups. One group is it's dramatically under-resourced and under-appreciated, and the other group think it's a waste of time. Have you noticed that the first group is sort of gaining more sway with the passage of time, and the second group maybe is growing quieter? Have you noticed any trends, either from an anecdotal point of view, just talking to fans, or from indeed at an official level, that the International Rugby League's importance is being recognised more or less? Are there areas that remain frustrating to you? What are your thoughts?
Well, I have to admit that I don't really know anyone in the second camp.
All right.
I don't really know anybody that dismisses international football outright. I'm sure there must be people like that, but I would say the vast majority of people understand the importance of an international dimension to any sport, for many different reasons, be that a performance pathway, be that visibility, be that government links and the opportunity to really join the international community of sport, which wouldn't be available without that international dimension. So I think that on the International Federation front, the fact that the organisation has had its first chief executive appointed fairly recently is a testament to its ambition. It's a marker that organisation is going to become something far more formidable, more robust, more active, and to really perform a leadership role globally for the sport, something that until now would have been assumed by national federations, which clearly isn't the most desired outcome for the sport. So I think we're living in a clearly more globalised world when it comes to viewership, when it comes to sports themselves. The need to make rugby league more popular to more people around the world is absolutely recognised by the people in charge of the game at the highest levels. And I think having a standalone international federation that's looking to increase visibility and revenue throughout the world will result in the international game going from strength to strength. We've had a World Cup, as is well documented, since 1954. We've not had a striving, functional international federation for that long. That is changing rapidly, and I think that will come with a commensurate level of change to the size and the depth of the sport in various places around the world. Some of the work that's happening in various countries and regions is exemplary, and the fact that we're able to continue growing is a testament to all the people who work in those federations and those regions, looking to push the sport and getting behind the International Federation, which is going to have a first genuine congress in Europe that I can remember in November this year. Going to be attended by over 20 countries. Again, that's a marker that the International Federation really wants to assume this leadership role. So it's an exciting time coming ahead of us.
Before we go, give us a bit of a glimpse into the future, Danny. Like, what are some of the things that you'd like to see you know, specifically in place, maybe in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years? What are some of the what's on your wish list?
I'm massively boring. I really believe in generational change. I really believe in organic growth. I really believe that if we as a sport are looking for silver bullets and for headlines that are going to solve all of our ills, it's not going to work like that. What we really need to do is stick to what we've been doing within the confines of our own confederation in Europe. High quality education in match officiating, in coaching, advice on competition administration, really promoting the idea of creating community clubs, creating community and domestic competitions, because any sport's only going to be as strong as its clubs. And if we keep promoting those areas of the sport while policing and regulating good governance and best practice within our national federations, then they'll become self-sufficient, they'll gradually become more confident and more capable, and through those national federations the game is going to grow. It's going to become a part of the sporting landscape in their own countries. Those federations will be recognised by their own sports ministries and national Olympic committees. We'll then, in the foreseeable future, I hope, be a member of the IOC. We had started a long process to become part of the Sport Accord. We're now looking to join the International Olympic Committee. And once we've achieved that, then we'll be legitimately in the international world of sport and be able to operate like all these other sports do on the international scale. So that's what I want to see, us joining Omni Sports Organisation with an increasingly self-sufficient, stable and confident group of national federations leading the way.
Okay, two really specific questions. I know I said the last question was the last. What is the time frame for being accepted by the IOC? And the question everyone asks me, when are we going to get an international calendar for the next, you know, decade? Or we're supposed to get one for 12 years in advance or something.
Yeah.
How far away is that? Two very specific questions.
I'll answer the second one first. David Collier's been working very hard with the various stakeholders on the international calendar. I think the first draft of that calendar may be presented to membership in Paris next month. And as for the second question, we are in discussion at the moment with the IOC. I'm not sure how closely you followed the incidents that followed the Sport Accord General Assembly earlier this year, but the President Visor of Sport Accord resigned, and Sport Accord had assumed the role of the membership clearinghouse, if you will, for international federations around the world. Now that Sport Accord ran into some problems, it shifted the focus of international federation regulation back to the IOC. So we're in discussion with the IOC at the moment, and we're pursuing that. We understand how important it is for the sport, and that is a singular aim of the international federation.
Danny, thank you, and thanks for the lift. I really had a lot of fun tonight, even though it was a long journey up there, wasn't it?
It was. Anytime.
And listeners, don't forget to go to wildlinefever.ning.com, and if you hit the Amazon button, you shop on Amazon, it doesn't cost you any more, but I get a little bit of a percentage. And also, even better, hit the donate button and donate like 400,000 euros. Okay, here's some more music. We'll be back with some more interviews.
Gonna love incense rising from your flame. so helplessly. No ask, no ask could ever see. No broken idols of mad passions make believe. No, no, no.
To the program, and it's
all right.
It's the second part of our interview with Marcus from Helloween. Marcus, over the years, you know, the band had, I know you've had a very stable lineup now for a while, but you there's been quite a few fellas in the band over the years, going back to the mid 80s. I just wondered.
Yeah, I know them all by name.
That's good. You can remember all the names. It was a two parts to my question. The first part is, are you still in touch with everybody? Is everybody still on good terms?
Yeah, well, I shared a plane flight with Michael Kiske. We had a nice talk. We had a nice chat. We had a good laugh. There's no, like, bad feelings anymore after all those years. I was, like, it was like fun sitting right next to him and telling him what we are going to do, and he was telling me what he's going to do in life situations and with his plans and all that. It was just like easy, you know. Kai is there. We had like a couple of tours together in Europe, and that was very, very cool. Even in South America, we hang out together and play. And, you know, it's just like very easy. I saw Roland on a festival and we had a nice chat. There's no big story anymore, you know. All those things happened in the past was just like gone. Everybody would like to have like a nice life without problems. It seems to be like this. And if we see each other, we share a beer, we shake hands. It's nice. It's easy, you know.
Yeah, you have been constant now. For the 30 years without a break. But a lot of bands sort of cash in on the reunion thing, don't they? They actually make money from doing nothing for a few years because then they get more money when they get back together. Do you ever kind of think you could have been a bit more cynical and maybe just sort of gone away and then had a big reunion, made a big deal of it and tried to cash in?
Well, I don't know. There's no such plans, you know, but as we all never say never, but we don't talk about it now because we're running into the next Helloween tour, and then we see what happened. I mean, we play with Kai, he comes on stage from time to time, and if we tour with Gamma Ray, he's on stage at the end of the show anyway. And we don't have such plans, but, you know, I don't know what future.
Tell us, at any point did you fear that there might be a breakup, that maybe the band wouldn't continue?
Well, with Helloween, well, there will always be Helloween as they are now, I guess.
In the past, going back, at any times when there were some lineup changes, did you think, well, maybe, you know, this isn't going to continue, you know?
Well, we have the feeling there's going to be a big change, and people probably, some of them or a lot of them are probably like complaining that this lineup was their kind of favorite lineup and it's going to be different now. But you know what you're going to do? It's not up to yourself. When things are going wrong and things are going in a totally different direction from what you thought it's going to be, you know. But we have to make changes, and you have to have the guts to make sometimes also cruel decisions to keep the band going, you know. I mean, we never were scared about it. It's weird. It's sometimes really tough to make those decisions. But as you also run a working business with a band, you know, you have to make decisions and to keep that business going as well, because it feeds all of us, you know.
Yes.
And then you stop thinking about, all right, if you're going to do it, like, if there's like a crack in the company, you got to fix it somehow with some decisions to make.
Yeah.
And it's not only fun and rock and roll, drinking and having a party. It's also about keeping the whole thing together, you know, and that means you have to make some not rock and roll orientated decisions from time to time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's we were scared of, you know? We just were interested to keep the band as Halloween, that to keep that trademark going with in the direction we want it to go, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's time for another song, Marcus. What should we play next? And is there a story behind that song?
Yeah, just play like some Lost in America. I think it's a great tune. It represents Halloween, I guess, very good. And, well, that's actually a true story. Got stuck on the airport, you know, for hours and hours and hours, almost missing the show and all that, you know, a life of a musician hanging around in the airport, drinking too much beer, and then because of too many hours waiting, you know. I'm a professional waiting boy.
We must wait. They started with a flight show, so the airport opens late. Nobody really told us, nobody seems to know. Now we're sitting here all drinking, we hope to catch the show.
We are lost.
All right, this is Marcus, the bass beater from Halloween, and you're listening to White Line Fever, and stay tuned. I like it.
Welcome back to the program, and we've just lined up the Angels, and we've got Nick Norton here. And Nick, what are, you've been on tour in Europe and Scandinavia with the Angels for the first time. What are the rooming arrangements been? Has everyone, you had to share a room with people?
No, we had hotels for the first two gigs, but we're all in a big house at the moment, and I'm sleeping in a room with Dave Gleason. And it smells like wet dog. I don't know why, but it's, I think it's just, you know, the clothes are old and soaked with sweat. But we're big, friendly men, and we're getting on famously with each other.
Now, when I saw you guys in Tasmania in a cafeteria and you first mentioned that this was on, it seemed hard to envisage. How was it sort of measured up to your expectations and your preconceptions?
It's everything you'd expect it to be. It's brilliant. It's amazing. I mean, I can't believe the Angels are in Scandinavia and Europe after 34 years, and I'm doing it with them. You know, it's like, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's a lifetime. It's my lifetime. So
yeah.
35 years. You know, and here we are. So
what have your experiences been with the fans you've encountered? Obviously, there's some very hardcore rock fans in this part of the world.
Absolutely. We just had some people from Norska here, Norway, and they're crying currently, so that's and they're treating me like I've been in the band for 41 years, which I have not. It's brilliant. Yeah, it's unbelievable. You know, it's all around the world, there's Angel fans like this.
Yeah.
It's kind of strange, but it's pretty special to be part of it.
Do you get the impression that maybe you'll be visiting more of those fans in future?
I'm sure we will. I mean, I can't see why we couldn't come back every year now. I mean, it sounds, you know, onwards and upwards. I'm always for, you know, that kind of thing. And I think we could easily do it. It's just a case of, you know, getting the logistics together and making it happen, you know. Where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, there's a fucking market here for it, so we can come back as often as we wanted, you know.
And have you got any funny stories that you can repeat?
Oh, shit.
Usually festival stories actually do involve shit somewhere.
That's right. we've been unusually in each other's face the last last week, so there's been probably a bit more friction than there would normally be. And keep in mind, there were three family members in this band, so normally family members get a little bit heated when like father like son, that kind of thing, although the brothers tend to just keep out of each other's way, although I saw an altercation or two, but we're all good. We make it work, we get on with each other.
When you go home to Brizzy, do all your buddy, all your friends know you're the drummer in the Angels? Like, does it have the gravitas that these people out here think it should? Or you
know?
Because Sam's friends are like too young to know who the Angels are.
Well, I'm in Sydney. Because I'm from Sydney originally. Mm-hmm. They all friends there say, mate, do you realise? Did you ever think about the fact you're in the Angels? And I'm like, well, you know, when I first got the gig, it just seemed like a really good gig. It was like, this is the best gig you could ever get. This is cool. I'm, you know, drumming sort of with the Angels, but then at some point, maybe 6 months in, a year, and I'm like, actually, I'm not drumming with the Angels. I'm drumming in the Angels, and I write songs with them and sing on with them and play drums with them and tour with them. It's like, well, hang on, I think I'm in the band, you know. So, seemed like it. So I was like, yeah, this is the real deal. And occasionally you do stop and go, hang on, fuck, I'm in the band. Like, I'm in the Angels. What the hell? But
it must have been gratifying to see Talk the Talk go down so well in that crowd. It's one of the best responses. And I guess at home, people are pre-wired that, oh, the new songs, I'm going to go to the loo, you know, but here everyone takes it on its merits, you know.
There's something about that riff, I think Rick's riff just,
it's awesome.
People just hear it and go, think it's an old song or think it's a classic Angels hit, and it just works, that riff. I'm always a bit like, oh, should we pull that one out to a festival crowd, you know, because we should just play all the classics, but we play it and it goes down. It's like, oh, I think they never knew it went down. They just probably think it's a classic anyway. Throw it in there and maybe one or two other new ones. Although on these gigs, you know, probably can't get away with more than maybe two brand new songs, you know.
Yeah. Was that a genuine encore or was it a pre-planned?
It actually wasn't encore because we always play way more than we should, and we always have much more music than we need. But we just, I think we were keen to stay under the, you know, the Scandinavians like things efficient and organised and on time, and we weren't allowed to play over time, so we were ready to, we just smashed through it, and you know, we play with a lot of punk sort of energy because it's a new crowd, and but it was, I mean, I think we came at 20 minutes short. It was like, fuck, we better play some more songs, you know. So we played a 20-minute encore and it was fine. And they were still asking for more. We could have played a second encore.
It sounds like you're going to have to keep your passport up to date in future years.
Yeah, I hope so. And next time we can actually, I'll just do the booking of all the plane tickets instead of John, and you know that way we can fly home in a day instead of 2 days.
Oh, really? Right. Would you come via where?
No, all over the shop. we'll be. I reckon we'll be back every year.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. So have a good night tonight, Nick.
Thank you, sir. Cheers, Steve.
Oh, this is off our last album, TITTS. Thank you very much. Take it to the streets. If you wake up in the morning and you feel all kind of hungover, blame us. It's Friday night. Good night for vampires. Taylor Lautner as a werewolf.
I got a white line fever. Going to run land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. And I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. You get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever. Rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.